Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 401, titled The Day of the Cynics. This is being recorded on March 3rd of the year 2003. Before I begin the main body of the presentation this evening, let me remind you that within a week or so of the airing of this program, there will be a detailed article-length annotated description of For the Record program number 401 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. Also, sister station WFMU-FM is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. More recent programs are streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery, DaveEmory. Older programs are available for download only on Real Audio at a longer URL linked to both the For the Record section of the Spitfire website and to the other WFMU URL. Be aware also that Spitfire sends the For the Record programs either on tape or CD to radio stations for free. So you can contact Spitfire at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005, or email them at mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. Now, in For the Record 401, named again the Day of the Cynics, we're going to be taking a look at some of the factors that are obtaining in the push for war in Iraq, or by the same token, the push for peace. And we're going to be taking a look at one of the things that I think makes it very difficult to be highly partisan over this situation, as dreadful as the prospects are. I think that as cynical as not only the Bush administration, but also, frankly, the French and German governments, and also a number of other institutions that we're going to be talking about are, it is difficult to cite a moral party in this particular confrontation, which is an argument that should be distinguished sharply from the issue of war versus peace and the terrible cost in lives that may very well be paid. And for the United States, anyway, it might very well turn out to be a very, very costly price in dollars, something that perhaps could throw this country's already tenuous finances into a terminal tailspin, to mix a metaphor. As I said, I think that there is cynicism to go around all the way on this, and we're going to be talking about some of the cynicism. One of the aspects of the confrontation between the U.S. and Iraq that has not received a great deal of publicity, and that concerns not just the issue of oil, but specifically the relationship between the pricing of oil in dollars versus the emerging euro currency. Now, I'd like to cite a couple of references to past programs. One, in general, in connection with September 11th and related events, I have been referring to the struggle for what the Nazi geopoliticians called the Earth Island, that stretch of land running all the way from the Straits of Gibraltar, all the way across Europe, Asia, most of the Middle East, the former Soviet Union, China, India, Pakistan, and that is a mass of land that they termed the Earth Island. It contains most of the world's land, most of the world's population, most of the world's petroleum reserves, and across the middle of it is a stretch of Muslim population. Karl Haushofer and the other German geopoliticians who influenced the Nazi thinking saw the control of that Muslim population as the key to world domination. And in turn, I have also spoken in, among other programs, For the Record 85, For the Record 100, and For the Record 126 about the emerging euro currency and specifically the challenge that it presented to the dollar as a reserve currency. Indeed, the European Monetary Union represents a development, albeit with a few changes, of a plan for German world domination that was developed by pan-German economic theoretician Friedrich Liest in the 1840s. And we've talked about that in numerous broadcasts, including a number of recent For the Record programs as well. What we're going to be looking at, first of all, is a very important article from the brilliant Berkeley professor, Dr. Peter Dale Scott. This is on Professor Scott's website at, I will list the URL on the written description for the Record 401. And this discussion talks about one of the very significant and yet not altogether well-recognized issues vis-a-vis the confrontation between the United States and Iraq. And it's not just oil, but specifically the pricing of OPEC oil in dollars and the possible threat that Iraq may present to that by pricing its oil in euros. And this, in turn, is to be considered in a much larger geopolitical and economic context. And I want to note that leaving aside the very real and significant feelings for peace on the part of many people, including, by the way, the advice of many intelligence officials in the United States and key military leaders, not by any means liberals or let alone leftists, people like Norman Schwarzkopf, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs Wesley Clark, people like James Webb, a much-decorated Marine Corps veteran of the Vietnam War, and former Navy Secretary under President Reagan, and many others have advised against the unqualified belligerence that the Bush administration has been showing. But there is an aspect of what the folks in Texas call the oil business that has not been discussed, and that is the dollar versus the euro as a reserve currency and as a petroeconomic indicator. This article, again, is by Professor Peter Dale Scott, the brilliant Berkeley professor. This is from his website. The headline, or its title, I should say, is Bush's Deep Reasons for War on Iraq, Oil, Petrodollars, and the OPEC Euro Question. Skipping down, we read, oil has been a major U.S. concern about Iraq in neutral, oil has been a major U.S. concern about Iraq in internal and unpublicized documents since the start of this administration, and indeed earlier. But the need to dominate oil from Iraq is also deeply intertwined with the defense of the dollar. Its current strength is supported by OPEC's requirement, secured by a secret agreement between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, that all OPEC oil sales be denominated in dollars. This requirement is currently threatened by the desire of some OPEC countries to allow OPEC oil sales to be paid in euros. As early as April 1997, a report from the James A. Baker Institute of Public Policy at Rice University addressed the problem of energy security, unquote, for the United States, and noted that the U.S. was increasingly threatened by oil shortages in the face of the inability of oil supplies to keep up with world demand. In particular, the report addressed, quote, the threat of Iraq and Iran, unquote, to the free flow of oil out of the Middle East. It concluded that Saddam Hussein was still a threat to Middle Eastern security and still had the military capability to exercise force beyond Iraq's borders. The Bush administration returned to this theme as soon as it took office in 2001 by adopting, some say commissioning, a second report from the same institute. This task force report was co-sponsored by the Council on Foreign Relations in New York, another group historically concerned about U.S. access to overseas oil resources. As reported by the Scotland Sunday Herald of October 6, 2002, quote, President Bush's cabinet agreed in April of 2001 that, quote, Iraq remains a destabilizing influence to the flow of oil to international markets from the Middle East, unquote, and because this is an unacceptable risk to the U.S., military intervention, unquote, is necessary. Again quoting, Vice President Dick Cheney, who chairs the White House Energy Policy Development Group, commissioned a report on energy security, unquote, from the Baker Institute for Public Policy, a think tank set up by James Baker, the former U.S. Secretary of State under George Bush Sr. And by the way, one of the things to consider in this context and in the context of the Middle East, and that is the deep sixing of the peace talks between former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak and Yasser Arafat of the PLO. Note that many of the key PLO negotiators at those talks were protégés of James Baker, termed Baker's Dozen by the Central Intelligence Agency, that Baker had recruited to coach these protégés, again Baker's Dozen as they were termed, in the late 1980s on PR techniques. I've discussed that in a number of programs. Note that the day that Dick Cheney, a petroleum executive like George Bush, was named vice president was the day that Yasser Arafat walked walked out of the peace talks. Note also that Saudi Arabia, heavily involved with the Bush administration and with the Bush family, including the younger George Bush, Saudi Arabia is the primary funding source for the PLO. And again, I've asked in a number of programs whether Baker's Dozen and the Saudis basically helped to deep six those Camp David peace talks, because had President Clinton successfully brokered a Mideast peace agreement, this would have very possibly given Al Gore the White House in 2000. As it is, the tensions in the Middle East ratcheted upward. The peace process is more or less dead. The Republicans had long courted the Israeli right wing. Demise of the peace talks basically doomed Ehud Barak's administration, and Ariel Sharon won the next Israeli election. And again, I think that James Baker's Institute for Public Policy, and obviously the fact that Bush and Cheney are oil executives, is more than a little interesting in this context. Note also that the top State Department official in charge with coordinating policy with, quote, friendly, unquote, governments in the Middle East, as I've talked about in a number of programs, is Elizabeth Cheney, and that, of course, is Dick Cheney's daughter. Continuing, again, quoting from the Scotland Sunday Herald in this article by Peter Dale Scott, the report, Strategic Energy Policy Challenges for the 21st Century, concludes, quote, the United States remains a prisoner of its energy dilemma. Iraq remains a destabilizing influence to the flow of oil to international markets from the Middle East. Saddam Hussein has also demonstrated a willingness to threaten to use the oil weapon and to use his own export program to manipulate oil markets. Therefore, the U.S. should conduct an immediate policy review toward Iraq, including military, energy, economic, and political/diplomatic assessments. Quote, the United States should then develop an integrated strategy with key allies in Europe and Asia and with key countries in the Middle East to restate goals with respect to Iraqi policy and to restore a cohesive coalition of key allies. Baker, who delivered the recommendations to Cheney, the former chief executive of Texas oil firm Halliburton, was advised by Kenneth Lay, the disgraced former chief executive of Enron, the U.S. energy giant which went bankrupt after carrying out massive accountancy fraud, unquote. And by the way, note that, as we discussed in For the Record 362, there was substantive evidence that it was Enron that was acting as the broker for the Middle Eastern oil pipeline deal that had been kicked around by, among others, Unocal, in which the elder George Bush holds stock. There had also been substantive reports that Saudi bin Laden Group was going to help construct that oil pipeline that was going to run through Afghanistan. And Peter Dale Scott notes in parentheses here, or in brackets, the Sunday Herald did not mention that the report begins with references to, quote, recent energy price spikes, unquote, and again quoting electricity outages in California, unquote, which we now know were engineered by Enron market manipulations for which two Enron energy traders have since pleaded guilty to conspiracy charges. That is from Forbes magazine of February 5th of 1903. The next section of Peter Dale Scott's article is called The Unstated U.S. Goals of Increasing the Flow of Oil from the Middle East and U.S. Dominance of the Area. Behind the acknowledged concern about the free flow of Persian Gulf oil are other motives. Following the recommendations of the task force report, the Bush administration wishes to increase international, which may well turn out to mean U.S. investment, in underdeveloped Iraq oil fields. On January 16th of 2003, the Wall Street Journal reported that officials from the White House, State Department, and Department of Defense have been meeting informally with executives from Halliburton, Schlumberger, ExxonMobil, Chevron Texaco, and ConocoPhillips to plan the post-war expansion of oil production from Iraq, whose oil fields were largely held by U.S. companies prior to their nationalization. By the way, I would add parenthetically, although it's not mentioned here, Halliburton Oil under Cheney had been deeply involved with the Iraqi oil production and its infrastructure even after the first Persian Gulf War. In fact, they had handled much of the contracting for the reconstruction of the Iraqi oil or the renovation of the Iraqi oil infrastructure after the first Persian Gulf War. Continuing with Peter Dale Scott's article, The Journal's story has since been denied by administration officials, but as The Guardian noted on January 27th of 2003, quote, "It stretches credulity somewhat to imagine that the subject has never been broached," unquote. It is worth pointing out that Saddam Hussein already has offered exploratory concessions, which remained inactive because of the UN sanctions, to France, more about that later, China, Russia, Brazil, Italy, and Malaysia. If Saddam is replaced by a new client regime, it seems likely that these concessions will be superseded, although there are reports that the U.S. has offered France, Russia, and China a share of post-war Iraqi oil as an inducement to get their support in the Security Council. Last September, former CIA Chief Woolsey threatened in the Washington Post of 9/15/02 that the price for participation by France and Russia in the post-war Iraq oil bonanza should be their support for, quote, regime change, unquote. It would not take much of such menacing talk from official sources to turn the Bush campaign against Iraq into a campaign against Europe. And again, I think that not just the Iraqi situation, but also September 11th, and also the Israeli-Palestinian conflict to a considerable extent, constitutes a geopolitical struggle not only for control of the Earth Island, but between what, for lack of a better term, might be called Germania versus Anglo-Saxonia, and the control of corporate Germany over corporate France is one of the considerations to take into account here, and the use by Germania, unquote, of proxy warriors, in effect, in the Middle East, read the Iraqis, the Al-Qaeda milieu, and its parent organization, the Muslim Brotherhood, and also the PLO as proxy warriors against the United States, and above all, in addition to any military damage and physical damage that might be done to the United States, in particular the economic damage from hugely increased military expenditures and consequent or coincident slashing of revenues through Bush's tax cut program, threatens to put the United States into a very, very serious situation indeed. Indeed, the economic situation in the United States is worsening dramatically. Time permitting, we will talk about that in some detail, but I would note, as I have discussed in past programs, that indeed Osama bin Laden himself called for his warriors to attack targets that would damage the United States economically. Nobody could be doing a better job of that than George Bush himself. And I have posited, and I would go to the mat with anyone, that in fact the Bush administration itself is a point element of what I call the Underground Reich, and its goal is to effect either the subjugation and or destruction, physical and or economic, of the United States itself. Continuing. Iraq's proven oil reserves are 113 billion barrels, the second largest in the world after Saudi Arabia, and 11% of the world's total. The total reserves could be 200 million barrels or more, all of it relatively easy and cheap to extract. Thus, increasing Iraqi oil production will diminish the market pressure on oil importing countries like the U.S. It will also weaken the power of OPEC to influence oil markets by decisions to restrict output. Indeed, were Iraqi oil production to expand to near its capacity, the quotas established by OPEC would cease to be honored in today's market. But the U.S. is not just interested in oil from Iraq, it is concerned to make political dominance over all the oil-producing countries of the region. Secretary of State Colin Powell gave a glimpse of U.S. intentions when he told the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on February 6th that success in the Iraq War, quote, could fundamentally reshape that region in a powerful, positive way that will enhance U.S. interests, unquote. In conceding that it will be necessary to station U.S. troops in occupied Iraq for the foreseeable future, the U.S. is serving notice to Iran and to Saudi Arabia, both of which were once secure bases for U.S. troops but are so no longer, that the U.S. will reassert its presence as the dominant military power in the region. The next section of Peter Dale Scott's article is titled "The Unstated U.S. Goal of Preserving Dollar Hegemony Over the Global Oil Market." Dominance of Middle Eastern oil will mean, in effect, maintaining dollar hegemony over the world oil economy. Given its present strategies, the U.S. is constrained to demand no less. As I explain in this extract from my book, Drugs, Oil, and War, by the way, that is about to be published, the present value of the U.S. dollar, unjustified on purely economic grounds, is maintained by political arrangements, one of the chief of which is to ensure that all OPEC oil purchases will continue to be denominated in U.S. dollars. This commitment to OPEC to dollar oil sales was secured in the 1970s by a secret agreement between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, before the two countries began to drift apart over Israel and other issues. The chief reason why dollars are more than pieces of green paper is that countries all over the world need them for purchases, principally of oil. This requires them, in addition, to maintain dollar reserves to protect their own currency, and these reserves, when invested, help maintain the current high levels of the U.S. securities market. By the way, I would add that the only reason that the U.S. got away with the kamikaze economics under the Reagan and first Bush administration was by borrowing against the dollar's status as a reserve currency. I want to add that we are now back into serious budget deficits under the second George Bush. Continuing with Peter Dale Scott's article, as Henry Liu has written vividly in the online Asian Times of April 11th, 2002, quote, "World trade is now a game in which the U.S. produces dollars and the rest of the world produces things that dollars can buy. The world's interlinked economies no longer trade to capture a comparative advantage. They compete in exports to capture needed dollars to service dollar-denominated foreign debts, and to accumulate dollar reserves to sustain the exchange value of their domestic currencies. To prevent speculative and manipulative attacks on their currencies, the world's central banks must acquire and hold dollar reserves in corresponding amounts to their currencies in circulation. The higher the market pressure to devalue a particular currency, the more dollar reserves its central bank must hold. This creates a built-in support for a strong dollar that in turn forces the world's central banks to acquire and hold more dollar reserves, making it stronger. This phenomenon is known as dollar hegemony, which is created by the geopolitically constructed peculiarity that critical commodities, most notably oil, are denominated in dollars. Everyone accepts dollars because dollars can buy oil. The recycling of petrodollars is the price the U.S. has extracted from oil-producing countries for U.S. tolerance of the oil exporting cartel since 1973. By definition, dollar reserves must be invested in U.S. assets, creating a capital account surplus for the U.S. economy. Even after a year of sharp correction, U.S. stock valuation is still at a 25-year high and trading at a 56% premium compared with emerging markets, unquote. But central bankers around the world do not expect either the U.S. dollar or the U.S. stock markets to sustain their current levels. As William Grider in The Nation of September 23rd of 2002 has pointed out, quote, U.S. economy's net foreign indebtedness, the accumulation of two decades of running larger and larger trade deficits, will reach nearly 25% of U.S. GDP this year, or roughly $2.5 trillion. 15 years ago, it was zero. Before America's net balance of foreign assets turned negative in 1988, note, under Ronald Reagan, the United States was a creditor nation itself, investing and lending vast capital to others always more than it borrowed. Now, the trend line looks most alarming. If the deficits persist around the current level of $400 billion a year or grow larger, the total U.S. indebtedness should reach $3.5 trillion in 3 years or so. Within a decade, it would total 50% of GDP, unquote. There is also a major potential threat to the overpriced dollar in Japan's unresolved deflationary crisis. As observers like Lawrence A. Joyce have commented, the dollar would take a major pummeling if the Japanese government, as seems quite possible, were suddenly required to fulfill its legal obligations to bail out failed Japanese banks, which could easily happen if a sustained scarcity of oil were to keep oil prices at $40 a barrel or higher. There is only one place where the Japanese government can get enough money to bail out its banking system. The Japanese government owns about 15% of our U.S. Treasury securities, and it would have to start selling them if it found itself facing a major banking crisis. That would send the already ailing dollar down even further, and the initiation of a sale of our treasury securities by Japan, of course, would immediately trigger a worldwide stampede to do the same before the securities became worth only a fraction of what they were purchased for. At the same time, interest rates in the U.S. would immediately go through the roof. Unquote. By the way, in that context, I would note the crisis now with North Korea and its nuclear armament. North Korea is a place I know nothing about, and I know nothing about how it came by its nuclear technology. As a general consideration, the international arms trade tends to cut across all ideological boundaries. One of the things that's interesting to contemplate is the possibility that of what I call the Underground Reich, which we know has worked with communists as well as right wing powers, Yaquism being a key element in that context. It'd be interesting to contemplate to what extent the Underground Reich might have been instrumental in helping to get North Korea some of its nuclear technology, either directly or indirectly. If the crisis with North Korea were to boil over, if North Korea were to threaten or in some way attack either Korea and or Japan, for example, that could cause a crash in the Japanese stock market, which could in turn trigger the very situation that Professor Scott is talking about here. So it's interesting to contemplate the crisis in Korea as a possible, in effect, a pincers movement. Again, what I like to call FFTGFFR, food for thought, grounds for further research, continuing with Professor Scott's article. Washington is, of course, aware of these problems and believes that overwhelming military strength and the will to use it supply the answer. Persuading or forcing other countries to support the dollar at its artificial level is the key to their own security. In an article entitled Asia, the Military Market Link, and published by the U.S. Naval Institute in January of 2002, Professor Thomas Barnett of the U.S. Naval War College wrote, quote, "We trade little pieces of paper, our currency in the form of a trade deficit, for Asia's amazing array of products and services. We are smart enough to know that this is a patently unfair deal unless we offer something of great value along with those little pieces of paper. That product is a strong U.S. Pacific fleet, which squares the transaction nicely." Unquote. There is some merit to this argument with respect to friendly countries like Japan, whose defense costs have been lowered by the U.S. presence in Asia. But, of course, the Islamic countries of the world are less likely to appreciate the great value, unquote, of a threatening U.S. presence. Instead, they are more likely to follow the example of Malaysian Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad and turn to the Islamic gold dinar as a way to diminish dollar hegemony in world markets and increase the power of Islamic nations to challenge U.S. policies. The United States has at present little reason to fear a challenge to the dollar from Malaysia, but Malaysia is an Islamic country, and the U.S. has every reason to fear a similar challenge from the Islamic nations in OPEC, were they to force OPEC to cease OPEC oil sales in dollars and denominate them instead in euros. And we are going to continue with discussion of Iraq and its sort of pioneer role in becoming the first OPEC nation to convert its reserves from dollars to euros. We're also going to discuss the declining status of the dollar relative to the status of the euro, and this is something that we've spoken about in recent For the Record programs. I think that this is indeed part of a strategy by the Underground Reich, or Germania, and that what we are seeing, in effect, is a geopolitical struggle and something of a reshaping of the battle lines of, or a reformation of the battle lines of World War II after the 50-year-plus hiatus that took place for the Cold War. However, we will be continuing with this in the second half of the program. There will be an article-length, detailed, annotated description of For the Record Program 401 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website within a week or so of the airing of this program. That is at www.spitfirelist.com. It's equipped with real audio and contains descriptions of the various programs that I've done over the years, and they are available from Spitfire. This is not an arrangement I get any money from. Sister station WFMU-FM is archiving the For the Record programs on real audio. More recent programs are streaming at wfmu.org/Dave Emory, D-A-V-E-E-M-O-R-Y, Older programs are streaming at a longer URL that is linked to both the For the Record section of the Spitfire website and to the WFMU.org/Dave Emery website as well. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 401, The Day of the Cynics, being recorded on March 3rd of 2003. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.